This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Guys, welcome to the Full Blast Podcast. Guess who's here? Jordan Lamote. Unbelievable. The man on a journey. But before we get to it, before we get to Jordan, we got a lot to get covered with him. Let's take care of a little business. Number one is our friends at Broadbeck and Ironworks. I guess they got a big deal going on. They're keeping their sale, their Blade Show sale, through the end of June. So all their sales that they had during Blade Show is continuing till the end of June. You cannot miss it. Definitely go over to BroadbeckIronworks.com and check out their discounts on all their packages, their discounts on all their, 15% off all their attachments and all that. And they have a pre-sale now on their little, on their power hammer. Their power hammer is great. I saw it at Blade Show. Definitely check it out. They're doing pre-orders. It's a great little power hammer. And you should definitely go over to BroadbeckIronworks.com and take advantage of their Blade Show sale through the end of June. I want to thank my friends at Evenheat. Evenheat are the manufacturers of the finest heat-treated ovens available. To find your next oven, go to evenheat-kiln.com. I had such a good time seeing the guys at Evenheat. Spence and Quinn, I've known that family for like almost coming on 10 years. And it's a wonderful family out in Michigan, and it's always great to see them and watching their families grow. And their customer service is awesome. They're kilns are the best, but their customer service really is something special. And I think that that's very valuable in this day and age, especially with small businesses supporting other small businesses. So I want to especially thank my friends at Evenheat. So go check out what they got going on there. Solid State Drive's awesome. Their tap control is awesome. All their stuff is great. Their customer service is dynamite. Go to evenheat-kiln.com and tell them I sent you. Or don't. You can just get them. Don't have to say a word. I'm with you. Next are my friends at Maritime Knife Supply. Maritime Knife Supply are the great company. It's a great company with Lawrence Lake for all your knife making needs, belts, abrasives, steels, kilns, forges, presses, heat treating ovens, anvils, and anything you can think of. File guides and material. And I spent some time with Lawrence at Blade Show, had a great time with him. And one of the things about Lawrence is he's a facilitator. So if you're in Canada and you're looking for something special, reach out to him. If you're in the United States and you're looking for something special, reach out to him. He's also a knife maker. He's very, very invested in the knife making community. He's involved with the New England School of Metalwork. He supplies a sponsorship every year for a student of any age and any experience to take a class at the New England School of Metalwork, and that's good enough for me. So if once again, support a small business that's part of this community and definitely get involved with Maritime Knife Supply. I really appreciate all you do. And if you want to get involved with the Knife Talk Build Along, go to Maritime Knife Supply. All the damage deal for the Knife Talk Build Along is at MaritimeKnifeSupply.com. I want to thank my friends at Trojan Horse Forge, makers of the stable rail knife finishing vise, and more. I love this vise. I have two of them, and all my knives are on this vise twice. Once for hand sanding, and once for finishing up the handles. It's a great company, another great small American company, making beautiful vises, overbuilt most likely. I mean, these things are insane. They come in a bomb-proof case, and they are awesome. They have this great plate that supports your distal taper. It supports your integral bolster. If you got a curved knife, don't worry about that. They'll take care of you. So definitely go over to TrojanHorseForge.com, put in the promo code FULLBLAST10, and you're going to get 10% off of everything, including their T4 Sentinel Oil, their handle press attachment, all that stuff. So go check out what my boys over at Trojan Horse Forge and stop playing. Next are my friends at Baker Forge. Got to spend time with Koi and the boys. Koi and the boys are making really beautiful, repeatable, exotic steels for you, the consumer. And let me tell you, they sent me some steel. It's super easy to work with, especially if you're in stock removal and you're looking for a little razzle dazzle in your life. Go to TrojanHorseForge.com. And if you put in the promo code FULLBLAST, you're going to get 10% off everything. All the copper mine, bronze mine, sand mine, mosaic, Damascuses, and all that stuff. I just got a pile of stuff. Boy, it comes out so great. And their gator piss etching is awesome. Name is the name. Hey, I'm not part of that. I mean, I don't come up with these names, but I'm not mad about it. This stuff is awesome. It's great, great etching. The name says it all, G-A-T-O-R-P-I-S-S. Alligator short for gator short for alligator, piss is short for urine. I don't know what to tell you. But definitely, stuff. All jokes aside, this stuff really works. And I would highly suggest getting yourself some and put in that 10% off with Full Blast. Full Blast gets you 10% off. And they have them at Maritime Knife Supply and other places. So definitely go check out that. Oh, man, I cannot thank my friends at Total Boat enough. Total Boat are the makers of great adhesive paints, primers, polishing compounds. It started out for boaters and DIYers, and now we're in the heavy in the maker community, especially all that, especially all the epoxies and all that stuff. If you're into river tables, definitely check out the river tables stuff they have. And I've just got some thick set Fathom epoxy stuff. It's just incredibly good. And I've started making hybrid handle material, and I love it. So go to totalboat.com/fullblast. And if it's good enough for Keith Deason, Derek Vermalden, Keith Johnson, Keith Mitchell, and even Jimmy DiResta, probably good enough for you. Highly suggested. I love the Total Boat two-part epoxy for handle scales. Definitely check out them. I want to thank my friends at G.L. Hansen & Sons, makers of G-Carta. That's gcarta.bigcartel for all your G-Carta. Stuff is wild, and it's great stuff, and it almost looks like brain coral. And it's because they're using all this fabrics and mixed epoxy under pressure and heat, and they're making these great blocks, and then they're cutting it off for you to make handle scales. And you end up with this really great material, and it really is really nice. So I'm a huge fan of Greg Hansen. He's doing some really great stuff. And if you go to gcarded.bigcartel.com, you get yourself some Bofa, Ripple Cut Tuxini, Mikey by Mikey, Mahi Mahi, Radio Worm Gcarda, Pheasant, Colorama, Hoopla, all that stuff. And the Golden Salami is coming soon, my own proprietary design for Gcarda. The Golden Salami is on its way. So definitely check out that, and highly suggest that. I got a great announcement to make. I'm going to Sweden in August with my boys at Tormek. Tormek are dragging me to Sweden. No, I'm just kidding. They're dragging me. They invited me to Sweden, and I'm going to go to Sweden for an event with them, and I am a huge fan of Tormek. They're now celebrating 50 years being in business with the Black T8 sharpening system. The water-cooled sharpening system is awesome. Go to Tormek.com or at Tormek_sharpening on Instagram. And let me tell you something. The Tormek has made me a better knife maker. If you're involved with, if you want to use the jigs, you can use the jigs. If you don't want to use the jigs, you don't have to use the jigs. It's really, really, it's a great company, and I'm very honored to be invited to go with them to Sweden. I can't wait. And I'm psyched. And a lot of great knife makers have been using the Tormek and really having great results. So definitely check it out over at Tormek.com. I want to thank my boy, Rob's Wildwood. Rob's Wildwood we're going to be doing something soon with him in regards to this podcast. But if you want to get some handle scales that's professionally stabilized, really great colors, great material, really good guy, go check out Rob's Wildwood on Instagram. Highly, highly, highly suggested. Love Rob. Been going to Rob every time I go to Blade Show. Always greets me with a smile, and he has got the best stuff around. So many, many thanks to my boy Rob. And last but not least, I want to thank my boys over at Pelican Paste for sending me over some Pelican Paste. Stuff is awesome. I really love you working with it. It was a lot of fun to get some. I really enjoyed the soft Pelican Paste, the hard Pelican Paste. Both of them are great. Definitely check out what's going on. Follow them on Instagram, Pelican Paste, or go to pelicanpaste.com. I want to thank my guest today is someone who's been here before. I feel as though I'm getting these milestones in his life. Jordan Lamote is an ABS master bladesmith. He is a musician. He's an actor. He's a singer. He's an artist in all forms. He's the total package, and he's on a journey. He's also a Fulbright scholar. Jordan Lamote, how the hell are you?
I'm doing well, Jeff. How are you?
I'm good. It was really great to see you at Blade Show. I always like to see that smiling face of yours. And it was cool to see you in your element. The last time we talked, you just gotten back from India, from an incredible voyage from India. And I just want to, you know, see how you're doing. What's going on?
Right. Yeah. Oh, gosh. Well, life's going on. It's good. Blade Show was a whirlwind for sure. It was great to see you down there. Great to connect with all of my other, you know, friends in the knife making world. It's a great kind of, unity moment among the knife makers in the year. So it's always fun to get ready to go down to Blade Show and then bring all a bunch of work down there and see everybody.
How did you think it went?
I think Blade Show was it went well. I mean, for me especially, winning the Best Chef Knife Award was a highlight.
Congratulations.
From a professional point of view. But Yeah, and just seeing everybody.
Wow, congratulations. Yeah. I didn't realize that you got the best chef knife.
Thank you. Yeah,
that's a
yeah.
Big deal.
It was a lot. There was some stiff competition. It definitely wasn't a given.
Right.
So I was really happy to walk away with that award.
So Bob Kramer must have been involved in that judging, huh?
He was, yes. Yeah, so that's an honor. I didn't get to connect with him, unfortunately, this time around. But I did last year when he would judge the Custom Knife Awards last year as well. So
someday I'm going to re-meet Jordan. I'm going to re-meet Bob Kramer. I had a very embarrassing Bob Kramer story, which I love.
No.
Now I love it. At the time, yeah? I didn't love it. This was about like maybe a year or two into making knives. And I got asked to go. I was invited to a sharpening lecture in New York City. And so it was a last minute thing. Jeff, grab your knife. You're going to meet Bob Kramer. Coming down here. I ran on the train. I ran to the thing. There was probably 9 people in the class. And it was Bob Kramer. And he was talking and he was saying, he's like, oh, you know, I judged a lot of, I look at people's knives, but if they wanted me to be critical, I'll be critical. But if they don't, I won't say anything. I'm no pressure. And he says, and if I don't really like a knife, I'll say, oh, that's interesting. And, so at the end of the thing, he was super nice. The funniest thing is I introduced myself and I was so, you know, shell-shocked. I was shell-shocked for a lot of reasons because it's Bob Kramer, but the other thing is because I think I was really tired, too. I ran down on the train. I wasn't expecting that, and I was exhausted. I was covered in sweat, I'm sure. And I said, I'm Jeff Fader. I'm a knives maker or something like that, or knives maker. I make knives or something like that. And then my friend says, go, show me your knife. Show me your knife. I'm like, no, Bob, don't want to see my knife. And Bob says, yeah, show me your knife. Show me your knife. And I knew that it was just like, I'm still pretty, you know, this is still like a little bit early for it to be, you know, shown to Bob Kramer. And I remember he says, no, I insist. I want to see it. I'm just like, oh, all right, well, there you go. He handed it to him. He looked at it. It must have weighed 5 pounds. I mean, it was big.
Yeah.
And he goes, oh, that's interesting. And I was just like, son of a gun. Exactly what he said he was going to say if he hates it. And I was just like, I got a great picture with him. And I was trying to make jokes with him. And I said, you know, I bought some hats from you. And my dog keeps eating it, so I keep buying your hats. If you see my name over and over again buying hats, it's because every time I buy one, my dog eats it. And then I got to buy another one. So we had a good laugh, but it was just like, I don't think I'll ever be able to live that one down.
That's funny. I wonder how he remembers it. You'll have to reconnect over that.
There's no way he remembers it. I mean, that's the funny thing. It's just like, I'm just one of millions who probably have gone up to him and said something or other. But I'll remember that as I like self-deprecating humor in general. So that's like right on. That's on brand for me. Like just getting that, you know, slight humiliation, which he was super polite and super nice. But every time I get these opportunities to kind of bring that story up, I always kind of like to, you know, lacerate myself with it. It's very funny.
Ha! I love it.
Do you think, I just talking to you and talking to like Ryan and a lot of other makers, especially the kind of the custom knife guys, you know, because when we go to Blade Show, there's vendors, there's the big knife sellers, and then the companies that's selling like, you know, big stuff. And then there's, you know, it's like people who sell materials for knife makers. And then there are a lot of ABS knife makers and then custom knife makers on tables.
Right.
Talking to a lot of different people from, you know, steel merchants and wood people to different, you know, types of knife makers. How do you feel this year went? In terms of selling knives at Blade Show?
Yes, but in terms of selling knives at Blade Show, particularly when talking to the custom makers who are making just, you know, one-off pieces, I think it wasn't a great year for sales. And that was basically the story across the board. I mean, whenever you get a bunch of knife makers together, they're always going to be talking about pricing and business and how it's all going. And that was the sense that I got from talking to just about everybody was, wow, this year is really slow as far as sales go. A lot of people who usually sell out had stuff left on their tables. I noticed that at my table as well. You know, I sold 3 pieces at the show, basically, whereas in the past I've sold out.
Yeah,
on the first day. So
I mean, you know, when you got the Master Bladesmith, I mean, I'm sure it was like you sold this stuff before you even, you know, had the chance to put it on the table.
Right. Yeah, that all went really quickly when I was there 2 years ago or 3 years ago, getting that stamp.
the people I talked to who did, you know, Lights Out were guys who were doing kind of lesser expensive knives, like something that was not, you know, something that you wouldn't have to like negotiate with yourself or, you know, somebody else in order to make the decision whether or not you want to buy it or not. And I talking to a lot of you guys, I definitely felt that. But the interesting thing was I was talking to my friends at the New Jersey Steel Baron, and they were saying that sales at Blade Show this year was down a third. Like it was down to they were getting a third of the business they got last year.
Interesting. Even for, because they're a supplier. I mean, they're in a different market than I am.
Right.
You know, they're supplying to knife makers. Because, which surprises me a little bit, because I would say of the people who came by my table, probably 10% were potential buyers. And I would say the rest of the 90% were knife makers who were curious about my work and inspired by my work and wanting to know how I did this, that, and the other thing. But you know, I definitely talked to a lot more knife makers than I did to collectors and prospective buyers.
Yeah.
Over the course of the weekend. So I would imagine that, you know, those suppliers like New Jersey Steel Baron, like the, you know, wood suppliers or whatever would have done pretty good business, but maybe everybody's just feeling like they're not ready to spend a lot of money right now.
Well, I think, and this is just my opinion, is I would think that wood guys do better in general because most people want to see this stuff in person. Like, that's the hardest part about buying online. Like, when you order some steel online, you don't have to look at the steel to know it's, you know, what you need. But when you're buying wood for handle scales or whatever, even Koa, I mean, the price of between, you know, regular Koa to heritage, exhibition grade Koa is like galaxy apart. So like the wood guys, I think, did really well, but the steel guys, I wasn't surprised because I feel as though because in the past year or so, or a couple of years, there has been a definite downturn in the knife community. And maybe it has to do with how Instagram is treating a lot of knife makers in general and people who are making this stuff. But there's definitely a connection. There's definitely a connection because if these guys aren't selling knives, they're also not buying more material.
Right, right. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I think it's just kind of the economy of the knife industry right now is in a tricky point. I think there are a number of reasons. I think the Instagram is certainly one of them. I think we're also feeling the collapse of the Forged in Fire craze. I mean, now that they're not making episodes anymore, that kind of arc has more or less completed itself, where when Forged in Fire came out, everybody was super excited about knife making. Everybody was getting into knife making, taking classes, buying all this equipment. And now it's that fad has started to ebb away. And I think we're noticing that. I think there's also just the economics of this moment where we're coming off the heels of a pandemic where everybody in the country got some free money from the government and had it to spend on either knives or knife making supplies. And so, you know, now that we don't have that free money anymore, we're noticing a drop in sales and also a glut of knives on the market. There's so many new knife makers oftentimes who are really, really talented. And so, you know, there's more competition in a field where there used to be less.
But I wonder, pardon me, keep going. Sorry.
Yeah. So it's all, I think it's a combination of all those factors that just made this year a little bit trickier to deal with, at Blade Show, not as good for sales.
Yeah. I wonder about it. I'm fascinated by it all, in general, because the pandemic was good to me. You know, I hate to say it in terms of the economics, and I think for a lot of knife makers, because it's something you can stick in a box and put it in the mail.
Absolutely.
It wasn't really like, it wasn't like a giant, it wasn't like installing furniture or installing, like, I have woodworking friends who are dead because, I mean, you're not going to be putting in like a custom-made cabinet or building furniture in someone's house during a pandemic, but you know, you can shove something in a flat rate box and send it off.
Absolutely. And I think that's, yeah, from most of the knife makers I've talked to, that's been the story that's been their story as well, is that the pandemic was actually really good for the knife business.
Yeah. I find it all fascinating, and also I also when I think about your work in general, and I was looking at your table, which is just incredible. Mm-hmm. There was that one piece with the carved handle, and it was hot. I feel like it was hollow in the middle. It that one beautiful, like that showstopper piece.
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So that's a piece that I made entitled Sojourn. It's a card is the style of dagger that it is, which is an Indian single-edged dagger. And it was made, I made it originally for Art Knife Invitational last year. And it was inspired by a number of pieces that I saw when I was studying in India. So that card design and I and a lot of the kind of proportions of the piece were taken directly from historical pieces, and then I added on the ideas of having this hollow handle, having the apple blossoms that were carved into the steel and pierced so that you could see into the middle of the hollow handle. All of those other, you know, additions were kind of my own creation. And the thematic elements behind that piece are rather personal to me. It's entitled Sojourn because for me it represents that trip that I made from my home here in upstate New York to India, where I really put down roots and made it my home in a sense, and then coming back. And so I have this Indian style that's very strong within the piece, but then I have those apple blossoms, which were some of the first flowers to come out back in the springtime when I was back here on my farm in upstate New York. And so it feels like it's a kind of bridge. That piece is a bridge representing that travel to India and back. And it's covered with gold kaftgari in a kind of Persian-inspired design. And I would say for me at this point in my life, that's that's the best representation of my capabilities right now, is that particular piece.
I mean, it is stunning. I looked at it a lot for a long time. I'm not a touch guy. I don't like touching people's knives. I just, for some reason, in my heart of hearts, there's a slim chance I might just drop it. So I just, in general, my move is just like, you know, enjoy it from, you know, the comfort of its own perch. I love that. I love that piece, and I love your description of it, because I feel as though when I look at you as an artist, I see so many bridges. Like when I said in the beginning that you're a man on a journey, I can tell that you're on a journey. And this, there's the concept of being an artist is about the evolution of a person. And when I think about the economy of the knife game, and I think about guys like you, and I think, well, Jordan isn't really, you know, really concentrating on the numbers at the end of the month. He's not looking at he's like on this, you're on a journey in general in terms of the bladesmithing and how you're connected to, as being a bladesmith and expressing yourself and having this physical manifestation of what you're going on through in your life.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree to a certain extent. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. That's that kind of artist portion of me is really important to what I do. And it's, I would say, the driver behind a lot of what I do. Not all of my knife making is like that. I mean, I do look at the numbers that I'm making at the end of the month and make sure that I'm making a living wage and all of that. And I'm also working on making, you know, lower price point type pieces that cater to a larger audience. But all of that really serves to enable me to do these really complex pieces that stretch my skills and that dig down to something a little bit deeper and more meaningful than just making a good kitchen tool.
Yeah. I also, one of the things I love about, I think that the unsung great thing about the art from an artist is one of my favorite things about art from an artist is that particular piece that you make when an artist makes it, that is a timestamp in the history of the development of an artist. And I love it. I see it like a milestone. And when I see a milestone, I'm thinking of a, like, you know, I always think of like the suitcase with like different stamps from different places it's been on and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And a particular piece of work, even though it's your latest work, in the history of you as an artist, it's just going to be another milestone. And then a year from now, you're going to be on to something different. And that to me is always like, it's the physical manifestation of being an artist at the time and at the specific moment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the artists who create work that ends up being really collectible, those their collectors get really into telling that story. I mean, that's, if you know, art collectors who are collecting, you know, Van Gogh or Renoir or whatever, you know, they're like looking at that trajectory, as you said, and that becomes the story that they tell that increases the value of their pieces.
But that's also, I mean, how, if you're in the art world, in the contemporary art world, and you're dealing with galleries, and you're dealing with, you know, your how you stack up in the art world, everyone's looking at your direction. And that's the thing that I feel a lot of knife makers should be being very conscious of, because it's you almost get this sense of sincerity, and you almost feel like my work is like everything's an evolution, even if it's the slightest evolution. And it comes from, you know, being a sculptor, and I'll see something that I like, and then I'll kind of, you know, do something based off of maybe a mistake that I made or a bit of spontaneity. And then that's how you kind of develop this sincere evolution of your work. And I kind of feel as though, especially this day and age, with where the economy's not terrific, especially for knife makers, that the idea of having these sincere stories, like the story of the Sojourn knife, has this real sincerity, and then it develops this connection between you and possibly the future owner.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. No, I agree, and I think that's a great way to look at one's trajectory through the craft. It reminds me of a moment that I witnessed at Blade Show. So my table was right next to Michael Walker's table. If you don't know who Michael Walker is, then you ought to do your research, because he's, you know, one of the biggest kind of influences on the modern folding knife design. Anyway. Michael Walker was somebody brought an old Michael Walker to his table to ask him about it, and he took a look at it, and he was saying, "Oh, it's got, you know, this little MW engraved in the blade, and this particular kind of lock, and that means that I made that knife in 1985, because that was the one year that I did both those, you know, that combination of things," and he was able to tell, you know, a good story of the knife and its development based on those little characteristics.
That is gotta be, that's the show. That's the next, you know, like Antiques Roadshow, where you give something that somebody made when they were very young and have them tell the story of it.
Ooh, I like that idea.
You know what I mean? Because, I mean, all of a sudden, you know, the funny thing is because Knife Talk has given me, like, I feel as though I might have a master's degree in knife maker sociology, and then, like, maybe a little bit of something. I feel like a master's degree is appropriate, frankly. And I listen to the questions that people send us in and the things that people say. And one of the things that they say often is, I hate my work from, you know, when I first started. My first 100 knives are terrible. I hate my stuff from years ago. And I was a victim of that, too. But if you were to be given something that, you know, maybe you did a certain time, you could even tell, like, I can tell when I changed my touch mark, or I could tell when I changed, when I got a different kind of grinder, or when I started a different technique. To give somebody something that they made a long time ago and have them kind of tell the story of where they were in that, because that's the physical manifestation of this moment in your life. But it shows the physical manifestation of a milestone in your life, but it doesn't tell the story around it.
Absolutely. So, and it brings back so many memories. You might have forgotten that piece entirely, but as soon as you see it and get to hold it again, then you remember what it was like to make it, what the conditions were, where your shop was located, what you were, you know, what tools you were using. All of that stuff just comes right back.
I could do, here's the first season, Jordan. You get Lynn Ray, you get Bob Kramer, you get Aaron Wilburn, you get a pile of guys who've been making it, doing it for a while. And then you get them, you give them something, you show them something that they're just like blown away by, like, oh my God, where'd you dig that up? And then they say, this is, I did this after the flood. I had a flood in my shop, or, you know, maybe, you know, my somebody passed away, and I, you know, I, this scratch here, I wouldn't have done now. And the reason why is because you could really kind of almost do like some type of a CSI of that knife, and
yeah,
even
exactly.
The techniques, like that would be, it would be a show for the 1% of the 1%, but it would be really cool to hear someone tell the story of something that they made when they were a child.
It would be rivetingly interesting for all five of us.
Yeah. All five of us. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. All five of us. That's right. Very good, Jordan. That's the funny thing. It's just like how we see our work in the past. A lot of people, like, I see old stuff. Well, sometimes now I've gotten to the point now where I see something I made like 10 years ago, and I'm just like, ah, look, here's where I was, and, you know, and that's the way that was, you know, 10 years ago. Jeff is a whole different person. So
I'm with you. Yeah, yeah, I'm with you on that, because I don't really get the, oh, my old work, I hate my old work or I hate the work that I did when I was beginning. Because, like, what's wrong with being a beginner? We all have to start somewhere. We all have to learn. And, of course, we're going to make choices that we wouldn't make now because, well, that's the beauty of the craft. I mean, if you were perfect right out of the gate, then what would be the point of continuing? I mean, you gotta keep learning and growing. And so I think that learning and growth is a beautiful thing. And sometimes you absolutely should look back on your work from 5 years ago and say, well, I wouldn't make those decisions now, and I would make that a little bit differently. But yeah, there's no reason to hate it, you know? You gotta love the process.
It takes age and maturity to kind of figure that out. You know, I think that number one is this society, we're all very like, we want some instantaneousness. Mm. But the other thing is, in the way we view the world with social media and everything else, we kind of skip over the fact that experience is underrated. You know, experience is underrated is one of my favorite new expressions I've been saying for about a year. It's like, my experience as a metal worker 25 years ago, 30 years ago, has informed the decisions that I make in the shop today. Right. And it's like, I come up to a drill press, the way I work with the grinder, the way I work with a right angle grinder, the way I work with a hammer and anvil, all that stuff comes from years of experience. And the hardest part is it takes age to appreciate that. We just turned 50, and I feel as though I'm on a journey. I don't feel the need to be at a destination yet, but I'm far more looking back at where I'm at now and the experiences that I've had, and I'm far more appreciative. And I'm trying to tell these younger guys, listen, you just got to understand that experience is underrated, and you're gonna do better over life. It's just kind of like just relaxing a little bit and under. Not when I say relaxing, it's just don't be so hard on yourself.
Absolutely.
That's the number one thing in Knife Talk. Knife Talk people say, I want to be like Jordan LaMotte. I want to be like Will Stelter. And I feel as though I'm, you know, it's just not coming fast enough. When should I go full time? I needed time to know when I can do this for a living. And there's this incredible impatience that we get weekly.
Yeah.
So
I get that. Well, and it's good to feel some of that impatience, sis. You know, that's what drives you.
I'm very excited. Oh, sorry, you were saying?
Oh, no. You can keep going. That was about the end of my thought.
I was gonna say, you know who I'm very excited for? I'm excited for Will Stelter.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm gonna have him on sooner rather than later. And I know that, you know, this year was very tough on the people who applied for ABS, the Master Smiths. I think that, I mean, I don't know the extent of it and stuff like that. I had a really nice conversation. He was disappointed that he didn't pass, but I feel as though this is going to be one of those moments that he's going to look back on and be grateful for. And
yeah,
it's
I would agree.
You know, because it's disappointing. It's got to be disappointing. I mean, the work that he did for his Master Smith set was just an extraordinary amount of work. And obviously, it's not as if when you get, and you would know better than anybody, when you get Master Bladesmith, it's not like taking a test where if you get a B-, you pass. I mean, you got to be an A+. You got to be an A+ to pass, which is like a staggering feat, A B minus anywhere is acceptable. Maybe not your family is acceptable, but I mean, some of most families, a B minus would be like, you know, be pumping your fist. For the master bladesmith, there ain't no B minus.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely right. And I Will's a good friend of mine, and I have every confidence that he's gonna get his master smith and with flying colors. I mean, he's a very talented knife maker. So yeah, I think he'll work that into his story with all of the drama that he maybe perhaps self-inflicted drama of doing everything at the very last minute this time.
You know what we need to do? Here's what we need to do. You need to pitch this show. You need to get one of them knives, and we're going to put it in a time capsule.
Yeah.
And we're going to – the one that, like, gave it to him, and they gave him the Fritz, gave the ABS, gave him the old, you know, B-minus or A-minus for in his situation.
Yeah.
And then we're going to look at him in 20 years, and we're going to have him tell the story. Because
that would be interesting.
That would be the story of, like, you know, the story of Will Stelter is this, you know, the fluted dagger. Like, he was showing me, like, how the fluted dagger was, you know, was what they saw and everything like that. But that would be the story. That's the problem with these shows. You can't wait 20 years. You know, we can't wait 20 years for this. It'd be an awesome story for him to, like,
right.
You know, you sit him down. I can see this. You know, all right, so 20 years from now, what, Will's going to be what, 25, 26? Just kidding. I'm making it. So you sit him down and you say, Will, you know, we wanted to know what you think about this. We plop down that fluted dagger, and he's just going to be like, oh, jeez. You had to do it to me. You had to do it to me. I can picture the show. I can totally picture the show. So
yeah, that'd be fun. Gosh, it's interesting to think about what the whole knife industry will be like in 20 years. If you think about how much it's progressed in the last 20 years, like where it's going to go.
Well, how do you feel it's gone in general from up till now? I mean, well, you're young at this, but at the same time, you're so experienced and you're so well-spoken about it. How do you feel it's gone up until now?
I mean, if you look at the trajectory from, I guess, the mid-70s when knife making was kind of reemerging in the U.S. as a trade to now, it's been a pretty consistent trajectory of growth. In terms of both participation, the number of people who are making knives, and also the quality from the objective standards of fit and finish and symmetry and knowledge of heat treating and, you know, metallurgy, you know, science of metallurgy, all of that stuff has really just been increasing in, you know, by leaps and bounds.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I think there's a limit to how much it can increase at that rate, right?
Yeah.
I don't know that, I don't know that it's going to continue to grow at the same rate in terms of, like, numbers of bladesmiths as it did in the last 10 or 20 years.
I would say one of the most interesting things to me, I had Laren Thomas on here last year, and we were talking about his new book where he was talking about the history of knife steel and knife making and stuff like that. We had this really interesting conversation of these two parallel worlds. Well, let's just say there's these two veins of the knife making world. There was the Bill Moran school, and correct me if I'm wrong, the Bill Moran school who kind of started the ABS or was involved with the starting of the ABS of forging knives and the idea of forging and pattern welded steel and making Damascus and this old school style. And then you had the Bob Loveless style. Of kind of more towards, you have these two avenues. The Bob Loveless style was using these super steels and stock removal and let's not fool around. And we, you know, it's almost like these two parallel rivers that came off this one. It was like a confluence. Well, what's the opposite of confluence? I don't know. So one river and then these two veins of the same river kind of became parallel. And the interesting thing is they both are still the stock removal versus the bladesmithing community is as big as it ever has been. And it's almost like these two worlds living together, but they're, you got the Bill Moran side and you have the Bob Loveless side. And when I walk through the Blade Show, I see that. I see both those sides very, very well, because you see, you know, the stock removal guys, a lot of good friends of mine, great guys who are just, you know, making it happen. And you see the bladesmithing community who are making it happen. And I do love seeing that these two icons have kind of inspired both these different avenues of the same craft.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. It's interesting to look at the tracks of those, you know, greats of the past who have kind of shaped the way that the modern knife making landscape exists. And I think, just kind of going back to the going forward, one thing that I think is going to really shape the way that knife making looks in the next 20 years is CNC technology. Yeah. I mean, that's definitely the newest growing edge, and certain people are really embracing using CNC techniques to speed up and streamline and make more precise whatever their current processes are. And the value of what is handmade is going to change and evolve in relation to that, I think.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think historically, the measure for something that is really good is something that is clean and precise, that fits, you know, all the fit is tight between all the pieces, and it's perfectly symmetrical, and the finishes are all really consistent. And as our machines get better at doing what we hold up to be the, you know, the pinnacle of technical achievement, then it actually becomes easier to do all of that stuff, and handmade starts to look sloppy again. Hmm. You know. Hmm. Because I would say even 20 years ago, you couldn't really make a knife on a machine that was as precise as the ones you could make by hand. And now I think it's the opposite in a lot of ways. I mean, a lot of the tactical folding knives, for instance, that are out there, that are just, they're super clean, work really well. The mechanisms are tight and lock up cleanly. All the finishes are good. They're all made completely on machine, or, you know, there are many of them that are. But I think there is still a value to that which is handmade. I think it speaks in a way that's different than a machine made object. It speaks, it communicates to our humanity in a different way. And I think that there will always be people who appreciate that side of things.
I would hope so, and I think so, because I personally, like, I have a, I'm friend, a very good friends with Aaron Goff, Goff Customs, who makes, whose YouTube videos on, he does incredible YouTube videos. He's probably, I refer to most knife makers as his illegitimate children, because he's helped the creation of a lot of people's ability to make knives. And I have one of his knives, and it all CNC, and it is incredible. But I feel as though they're going to be, CNC is going to be great to take away a lot of the difficult work and make things a little bit on the, you know, the construction a little bit easier. But I feel as though as we grow as custom knife makers, not necessarily turning into giant companies, customers are going to be seeing you more as an artist, and you're supporting the particular person as opposed to the product that you're making.
Right.
That's what I'm hoping for. I mean, my direction has been completely different from most knife makers, because I was a sculptor, and I was, you know, I had a studio art degree, and I made sculpture for a long time. I lived as being a sculptor. And to me, the knife game, my knife company is my version of what I enjoy about making sculpture.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing these moments of these little trends. I'm making these tiny, tiny evolutions, and I'm kind of going through these different things, and I'm enjoying it as a whole, as the company is the sculpture to me.
Right.
And I'm starting to get more and more. And as business has been weird. We're dining on the backs of a repeat business. Like our customer, I mean, my customers are coming back, and I'm getting more about these people who are trying to, they want to be involved in supporting the things that I do. And I feel as though that's the thing that a lot of these CNC companies are going to lose out on.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I wonder, I think they might, or they might not. I think in either case, you sell much more than a product. You sell a story. And
right.
So if, even if a CNC company is able to write a good story based on, you know, that tells the story of their product and their design and their manufacturing philosophy and whatnot, they may be able to overcome that hump. But yeah, I think the personal ones, the personal stories are going to be more potent in the long run.
I mean, the Sojourn Dagger, which is stunning. It's stunning to see, and hearing the story with the apple. Well, as soon as you said apple blossoms, like ain't no apple blossoms like there are in upstate New York. I mean, apple blossoms in upstate New York is where it's at, and that you telling that story would be impossible any other way. And your use of Kafgari and your use of these traditional techniques that you're executing in your style and design. You're telling the Jordan Lamote story, which is something that, you know, plugging into a CNC just ain't going to happen.
Right, right, exactly. Well, and I've also made a concerted effort recently, and in that piece in particular, but in other work that I do, not to compete with CNC stuff. You know, I try to use techniques that are not easily replicated by machines.
Right.
And, you know, work on things that aren't square, for instance, you know, like and use joinery techniques, you know, soldering and brazing that are much more difficult to mechanize. And yeah, I think it does lend a unique quality to try to think about, okay, how can I do this in a way that is really playing to my advantage as somebody who makes things by hand.
I don't know if this is irony, but what's fascinating is when you look at, and when I was talking to Will and he was showing me, he was talking about symmetry and talking about fit and finish and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
The expectations of, I would assume, the ABS judges in basically any of the different tests,
yeah,
is you're looking for CNC quality not done by CNC.
Yep.
The irony of ironies is you want that CNC result done by hand.
Yep.
That's irony, isn't it?
It is. It is. Though I think it's also a product of the way we've designed our machines, because we've designed our machines to make it easier to do the things that are the most difficult for us. And actually, maybe more than to do the things that are most difficult, they do the things that we prize the highest. And so really good craftsmanship is something that we've tried to make machines to be able to replicate, because it's impressive and because it's valuable. And so I think it's a really valuable thing to be able to meet that level of standards with hand finishing. I think it's really important. I hope that never goes away, because obviously there are some imperfections when you make things by hand. But if you can get your skills to the point where those imperfections are indiscernible to 99.5% of the population, there's a real value to the quality of craftsmanship that you possess.
And you know what's funny about this, and I don't struggle with it. I like to I'm big into pondering. You're 50 years old, you got to ponder. You know, when you look at art, the way art has changed over the years, there was these schools, these art painting schools, where it was so strenuous, and everything would look like just, I mean, you look at, you know, the masters, and you look at the way art was supposed to be, and not just, you know, the painting quality is one thing, but then the subject matter, everything meant something, and there was this level of proficiency that was just like the highest of high levels. And then there was this, like, this change into finding some spontaneity and finding some humanity, and like that kind of the humanity of the painting changed. Mm-hmm. And there was this like, it was this level of it was obviously to a lot of the classic masters, it was frowned upon. But then you had this, you know, beautiful, you know, wildness that was just like spontaneity, and you just, it wasn't planned, and it was supposed to be like that, and it was like almost like a child had done it, and right. it was this level of sincerity that it was more like a humanity, it was like a degree of humanity. And I feel as though that there's a lot of like duality between the way the art world is, or the art world was, and the way the knife game is now.
Yeah, maybe we're hitting our modern era in knife making. Is that what you're saying?
Well, you know, here's a good example.
We're exiting the classical era. And
I talk to Josh Prince a lot. Yeah. I love Josh Prince. And yeah. I remember when we first met, when he and I first met, it must have been Blade Show. We'd been, you know, knew each other for a long time. But there was definitely this moment, and he and I have talked about this particularly, and I talk about it a lot. When he came on the scene, you're talking about a guy who, Joshua Prince, was the son of an artist, not only just an artist. His father was a professor at the Rhode Island School of Design. And if you don't know, Rhode Island School of Design is one of the best art schools in the country. I mean, to be a professor of art at the Rhode Island School of Design means, you know, it's not an accident. This guy is like incredible. Josh said, I grew up and there was table saws in the kitchen. There was art going on all the time. I grew up going to art galleries. I grew up going to seeing artists. I lived the life of an artist. So when he started making knives, I feel as though in the beginning it was, and I'm not saying anything I haven't said to him. I feel as though that the way his work was taken was almost controversial. And there was a lot of it that was just like not taken as seriously. When I say controversial, I'm using that word dramatically. And like I said, he and I talked about this even every time I talk about it. Now he has become so innovative in his decision making. I could see, you feel as though that there was this change in the way people looked at knives, especially his knives. It went from to like, this is unbelievable. I mean, this is like breathtaking. Yeah. And I find that that's one of them. One of my favorite things to, when you look upon, you know, the this very short history. I mean, you're talking under eight years. I mean, mm-hmm. It is a breathtaking change in the way people see knives.
Yeah, I would agree. I think Josh is a great example of that, as somebody who's been able to kind of reframe the way that knives are viewed and the way that knife making manifests.
Innovative. I mean, that what he's done, but it wasn't accepted in the beginning. And then that's the thing about art. You know, in the beginning, those guys who were just like slapping the paint around, it wasn't accepted. And then all of a sudden, as the trends change, and it makes me wonder what's going to be next in the knife game, because obviously things change. I mean, there are things that change, and I feel as though I'm a rubbernecker. I rubberneck what's going on in the trends of the knife making game, and I just enjoy it. I love
yeah.
rubbernecking.
No, that's your job as a podcaster.
Yeah,
right?
I guess. Yeah, as a honorary master's degree holder. I'm an honorary master's degree holder.
Yeah.
Of rubbernecking the knife game.
I love it.
So, I want to ask you I had a few questions for you.
Sure.
If you're listening to this for the first time, I did a number of episodes with Jordan, and Jordan has got incredibly talented family, musically, artists. They're performers. Your father is just incredibly talented. I remember reading something where he would do concerts, and no concert was ever the same. It was all, mm-hmm. you know, everything was spontaneous, and there was no two shows alike. And it was, but like, just you guys are obviously incredibly talented. Where did you get the discipline and motivation to get to where you are?
I think discipline, motivation. Discipline's an interesting word because, well, let's start with motivation. I think that because motivation, I think, comes from really a passion for what I'm doing more than anything else. And I've always really loved working with my hands. I've always loved working in a variety of different materials. And so when I found knife making, it all the pieces seemed to fit. You know, it was really a thing that I loved doing. I could explore all these different avenues of different ways to make things within the same, you know, genre of making knives. And so it checked all the boxes for me, getting to work in different media, getting to do these, you know, kind of intense, technical, precise actions, you know, where I'm working on, you know, making something really, really precise and detailed, but then it also had the avenue for artistic expression. So that sort of passion is really what motivates me the most. I mean, and then I think the discipline comes in because it's never an easy road the whole way. You know, that motivation, your passion for something needs to be fostered. And I remember my mom telling me, you know, from a really young age, you know, anything you love and is going to take work in order to maintain that love, because the love doesn't maintain itself. You need to kind of foster that passion for what you do. And that's, I think, what the discipline is to say, hey, you know, this is really what I, not only what I love to do, but what I want to love to do. And to figure out ways to make it fun for yourself, even when you're burned out or when you have, you know, a huge long backlog of work that you're not super excited about, or when you need to, you know, put down your passion project for a month to, you know, make some money so that you can, you know, get back and work on the things that are the most exciting. So I think that's the combination of motivation and discipline. And yeah, it comes from the passion, but also from just a dedication to making it work. Because at the end of the day, when I think to myself about what I want to be doing, I want to be making knives. I mean, I want to be working for myself, making knives. And even if that's really hard in a given moment, it's still true that that's what I want to do. And so I figure out how to make it work, how to adapt to whatever the particular circumstances are of the day.
But I wonder, even on a deeper level, I mean, obviously your parents are very, very supportive of you and your brothers and sisters. There must have been a very early set of, not expectations, but like, you know, you were instilled, especially if you're, I mean, you were as a family, you perform together. So there's a lot more, there's probably rehearsals, probably maybe not when you want them to be. And there's like this, there's an expectation of how it's supposed to all turn out, and the understanding of the work to make that family thing work. I would imagine that there's probably a very deep unconscious connection between succeeding as how you have as a knife maker and the early stages of the development of your as a performing artist with your family.
I think you're absolutely right, Jeff. I think. So my theory on this is that your children learn by watching and imitating much more than they do by being told one thing or another, or by being made to do something. And so what I witnessed growing up in my family was my parents, who are each individually deeply dedicated to their particular art and their work, and together are dedicated to creating this really tight family unit that works together. And so seeing those that combination of dedication has always been an inspiration to me. And I think consciously or unconsciously, that's the direction that I inclined my own path is toward that sort of deep engagement with the craft that I love and with the people who are around me.
It's hard. Discipline's a tough one because, you know, it usually has, you know, negative connotations in general as an American. You know, there's a lot of, you know, having the discipline to do certain things is 100% not like it. It does not equal a hamburger and French fries. You know, it's like these two things are on different scales. And I think that the crazy part, what I never understand is, once again, back to Knife Talk, we get messages weekly saying, what do you do when you don't feel motivated to go in the shop? Or what do you do when you go in the shop, you know what to do? Or what do you do when you're not feeling creative? And I always say, like, look, you know, some of this stuff is not meant to be easy. And for me, when I was a blacksmith at the Center for Metal Arts, and we're talking, you know, 15 years, more than 15, almost 20 years ago when I was started as a fabricator.
Yeah.
I never forged before. I didn't even, when I got the job, I didn't even know anything about blacksmithing. I thought it was, you know, I didn't know anything about it. And then when they had me taking classes because they wanted me to be proficient, I realized that the tenets of blacksmithing and forging is so much more of a philosophical thing. It's so much more intellectual in terms of you have this technique and you have to have a very firm understanding of what you do, and you have a very limited amount of time to do it. And when you do those things, you have this material and you have it heated at a certain temperature and you're using a specific heat, you're using the specific tools and you're holding things at a certain angle and using specific parts of the anvil, and then you have a certain amount of time to work within that confines. There's no fumfering around in order for you to kind of express yourself. You have to be disciplined enough to understand that you have a very short period of time to create this excellence. And what happens is, the greatest part about blacksmithing is, when you're done and you see all the mishits, it's a physical manifestation of your clouded or cleared mind.
Mm.
And it got to the point where it became so, for years of forging and working with Uri Hoffi and working with other blacksmiths and, you know, getting yelled at or getting praised or getting it right or getting it wrong, I felt as though embracing being organized and disciplined was the only way to have the success that it was demanded of me, what I was getting paid to do. I was getting paid as a blacksmith and a fabricator to do it right. And if I embraced organization and discipline, things went well. Well, it got to the point where 10 years ago, I was just like, well, if I'm doing that with steel, why wouldn't I do that with everything else in my life?
Mm.
And I completely thought, and this is the crazy part that I just can't understand with other makers and stuff like that, especially blacksmiths and bladesmiths. How can you not use this incredibly amazing, you know, illustration of getting to success? You like to forge, you want to make a hammer, you want to make a knife, you want to make an axe, you like that stuff, you like it, and you know what you need to do to kind of create this degree of excellence. You see, you know, I mishit there, I know what I did wrong there, the eye's off there, I know what I know, next time I won't do it. Why wouldn't you put that in the rest of your life?
Yeah.
And I completely 100% embrace that with everything.
Absolutely.
And it's like, to me, discipline has become like a comfort to me in regards to the success of not even as just as with Fader Knives, but being a parent and a husband.
Yeah.
Like that was like critical to that translation over to life.
I really like that way of looking at it. I think, you know, discipline, as you were saying, is kind of a fraught word. It does have these kind of negative connotations the way we use it. Like, you know, if you're being disciplined for some, you know, mistake that you made or something you did wrong. I guess I like to think about it in terms of, you know, figuring out what the enabling conditions are for your own success. You know, what, so if I'm going to get from point A to point B, if I'm going to forge a taper on this bar, what are the conditions that need to be right? You know, I need to have my body positioned in this sort of way. I need to have the heat on this portion of the bar. I need to have, you know, the right hammer. I need to hit it at the, you know, particular rhythm. You know, all of those sorts of things are like the enabling conditions of that success. And I suppose you can think about it in terms of a discipline, like, you know, I have my plan and I'm executing it. But maybe that plan and executing it is an enabling thing rather than a kind of top down, you know, if you don't do it this way, you're going to fail.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
just a positive way to reframe it, I suppose. I think you and I think very similarly in terms of really, you know, trying to apply that process and that kind of attention to, you know, what makes you succeed to all of the aspects of your life.
It's the crazy part is like, I remember a specific moment. I got invited to Blue Hill and Stone Barns, which is a very famous restaurant near me.
Yes.
One of the best chefs in the world.
Dan
come
Barber.
Through there. Dan Barber, right. And they asked me to speak to all the chefs for an event. And I was just like, all right, let's do it. And I thought to myself, well, what the hell am I going to say? And then I realized, well, if I was forging something, I would be, you know, organizing myself so I was 100%. Because that's the other thing about forging for me. It's, and when I teach at the Center for Metal Arts, I say the most important thing is when you put the steel, before you even put the steel on the heat, you have to know exactly what you're doing every heat. Like there has to be no room for, you don't pull it out and look at it. You know, I'm going to the anvil like this. I'm going to hold it to 45 degrees. I'm not going to find a radius corner. I'm going to find a sharp corner. I'm going to hit it halfway on, halfway off. I'm going to hit it three times. I'm going to push out whatever comes out through this, you know, from the sides, and I'll push it back in. I'm going to straighten it and then take a look and then put it back in. Every heat is very disciplined in order to kind of get it across with your efficiency. And that's what I did with this event. I was like, I'm going to know exactly what I'm going to do and say to assure that it's going to go right. And we did a slideshow, and I had a very, you know, a whole thing to say. I knew exactly what I practiced. I knew what I was going to say. And when I got there, it was great. But I was like, I definitely 100% thought, well, if I was forging a knife right now, or I was forging a picket, or I was forging a sculpture, what would I do? And I would use those same tenets in order to extract a degree of success for something outside of it. And that was it. It was like everything is now forging, to the point where it's like everything is the same philosophies, and I can't wing it anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and it's gotten to the point where it took me a long time. It took me probably 30 years. Let's say 40 years. It took me 40 years. Let's say 35 years. Let's be generous. It took me 35 years to realize winging it sucks. Winging it is not, for some people it's great. For me, man, it's never a guaranteed winner.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I get that. And I think for the people who like to wing it, they're comfortable operating in that sort of capacity because they have a process for how to wing it. You know, it's not like it's completely.
Yeah. I'm not bagging off.
Yeah.
It just don't work for me.
Right. I totally get that.
On a podcast.
You figure out what your enabling conditions are for success. And having a plan is one of them.
Who are your inspirations?
Oh gosh.
Even from a young age, was there somebody, it doesn't have to be a knife maker. Who are the people that you were really kind of like looking towards? I'll give you a minute.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, I guess like obviously my parents were big inspirations to me growing up from a really young age. And then, you know, in the knife making world, I have a lot of different inspirations in terms of directions that I want to go with my business or with my art. I mean, I think like current inspirations in the knife making world, Zach Jonas is definitely one of them.
Oh yeah.
I think he's someone who's just very thoughtful and attentive to the balance between business and art, and strikes it in a graceful way, and he makes some really great work. Is inspiring and also, you know, is able to run a good business, and so that's inspiring to me. Peter Johnson, big inspiration from the artistic perspective. He has a kind of freedom with his expression that I find inspiring.
His inspiration is based also on tradition too.
It is. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm fascinated by his whole, Peter Johnson teaches these incredible, anytime you see any pictures from Peter Johnson's shop, it's a murderer's row of knife makers who are sword makers who are just like, you look at them and I mean, it's like the dream team. It's like the dream team of students. And he's teaching these traditional ways of making knives using compasses and the scale of things. And I love everything he does.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's deeply rooted in philosophy. He's very philosophical with the way that he approaches his work. And I think that that's quite inspiring. I mean, just coming from Blade Show, looking at Vince Evans' work, Vince Evans is definitely an inspiration to me. He's even more rooted in tradition and history than Peter Johnson with his historical replicas and historically inspired pieces. But I think his interpretations of them are quite inspiring. On the other side of things, Jürgen Steino is an inspiration to me as well, in somebody who has such a well-developed sense of style, making work that's completely fresh from, you know, work that came before and looks really unique and is just unquestionably his own. You know, he has some really astounding work out there. So
I love this question because it, for me, it's always changed. It's mm-hmm. always changed because now when I was younger and I was an artist, when I was a kid, I grew up in New York City in the 70s and 80s, and Keith Haring was like so important to me as an artist, as an artist for a city, because he took art out of the galleries and put it on the streets for people to enjoy. And I felt as though there was this really like bringing out of the galleries was a big deal. And I felt like being approachable to people was a huge deal. So the inspiration I've had, I've always credited him in terms of inspiration because he's taken art away from the select few and then been able to kind of make it approachable towards everybody. And I think that's part of why I do every time I've ever made sculpture, I'm never trying to choke anybody. And the same thing with the knives is like, I want people to have them. And I feel as though I know for a fact that Keith Haring had a huge influence on me from a very deep level of taking things out of the Soho galleries and bringing it to the streets. And as I've gotten older, I'm now finding more inspiration from professional athletes.
Like really?
This has been like professional athletes have been such an inspiration because it's not just what they're doing. There's this incredible amount of excellence performed at the highest levels in front of people all the time. And you have this incredibly limited time frame in which to do it. And I mean that as in like when you listen, basketball to me is like, it's jazz. It's unbelievable. I love basketball.
Yeah.
And I love listening to basketball players and I love listening to them talk about basketball because, you know, you don't hear about guys over 40 playing basketball. So the time frame to get excellent is so you have to at an early age, and then you have to capitalize your excellence, because at a certain point you're done. I'm 50. You know, I'd be 20. I mean, even I can't play sports, but like I'm like 20 years removed from being a good athlete, and it's crazy. So I love watching these young athletes who have been competing at the highest levels from an early age and exhibiting excellence with a very short lifespan of their career.
Yeah. Oh, I can totally see that. I get that. I get some inspiration from professional musicians as well. I think there's a comparison to be made there between athletes and musicians. Both are performing in real time in a way that we don't really have to as knife makers.
Yeah.
That is quite inspiring and awe-inspiring as well.
Speaking of time frames of like your career trajectory, I was listening to this podcast and the coach of the Knicks, Tom Thibodeau, who is just dynamite, really, really well spoken and just like an awesome coach and stuff like that. They were asking him about the trajectory of his career. And it was interesting because he was an assistant. He played college and he wasn't very good. And he was an assistant coach, and his trajectory of going from being an assistant coach to being a coach, I think he was assistant coach at Harvard. And then he was a coach. It was a 5 years of coaching got him to the NBA, to be a coach in the NBA, which is like, if you think 5 years for anything, including just getting to the level of the highest of the high levels. And when they asked him about it, he said, "I was surrounded by great people and I took opportunities of good breaks," as in like an opportunity. I was surrounded by good people, and then I seized upon opportunities that have presented themselves at specific times, and I got lucky.
Yep.
But I love that. I love that as an analogy, and just in terms of like, you know, a lot of times people will say, "How do I get like this guy? How do I get like that guy?" And I love seeing how professional athletes bridge the gap from being kids to being on the greatest stage in the world. And like, an opportunity presents itself, what do you do?
Yeah, right. Well, you got to take it.
Some people don't want to take it. Some people don't want to put themselves out there either. Yeah. And I love, to me, seeing people performing at the highest level with just incredible scrutiny and just succeeding. There's a baseball player, his name's Alex Verdugo. And he used to play for the Boston Red Sox, and now he plays for the Yankees. He's been a dynamite offseason. You know, they got him over the winter, and so yesterday the Yankees played the Red Sox, you know, this incredible rivalry.
Right, right, right. I grew up in Boston, so yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm well aware.
So yeah, so Alex Verdugo used to play for the Red Sox, and he might have chirped about how he's glad he's not with the Red Sox anymore. He might have said a few things that probably was, you know,
how
young
dare
guys.
He?
Young guys, they shoot their mouths off, they chirp, you know, that's the way it's going to be, you know? So he gets up to bat yesterday, and the boo birds are out. They are booing him. You know, they're in Fenway Park. They're booing him.
Right.
They're booing him, and he knew it. They said to him beforehand, he's like, "How do you think you're going to be treated when you go up to bat against your former team?" And he says, "I'm going to be treated like a Yankee." It was an awesome line. He gets up. They're booing. The boos are out of control. Out of control. They are, you know, you can tell, you know. I mean, no offense to Boston, but I mean, come on. You guys are rough. I mean, don't talk about Yankee New Yorkers being rough. Boston people, I mean, they're tough. And you should be happy. The Celtics are doing so well. So beyond the point. So Alex Verdugo gets up in the box, and he drills one over the Green Monster. And the boos stop, and he's pumping his chest, pumping his fist. And it was like he did something with the whole stadium was against him, and he succeeded at this moment. Baseball has got to be one of the hardest sports. I mean, hitting a fastball is just mind-numbing. 100-mile-an-hour fastball is mind-numbing.
It's crazy. After sitting on a bench for, you know, 3 hours.
Right, like, right. Sitting on the bench, and all of a sudden he comes up, and then he murks one. He murks one right over the Green Monster. The whole stadium goes quiet. He's pumping his chest. He's hitting his head. He's pointing at the audience. That's right. That's right. Let's go. Let's go. It was an awesome moment of like succeeding and excellence, you know, exhibiting excellence at the highest level with the most scrutiny possible. I love
absolutely.
That stuff. I love
absolutely.
That stuff. That's the stuff that feeds me. I just like, how do I get to the point where I'm confident? Because I see that all as confidence. That's why I asked you how you got so confident.
Mm.
I feel as though that there's a level of confidence that people either have or they don't have. Mm. And it's like, how do you get to the point? Here's a good example. This is what I really wanted to get to for you. I'm going to take me back. You're in India. You're having a great time. Fulbright scholar. You're all over the place. You're learning Kafkari. You're in with families. You're eating the food. You're talking with them in their language. You're being part of their community. There's a video of you. I've never stopped thinking about this, and I've got this now. They got you up on stage.
Yeah.
No shoes on. The music starts to play, and you're dancing in the, I would assume, it's the traditional technique or the traditional dance of the song that they're playing. and all you see is you are in it. You're in it. You know, pale. you're a white guy from New York, you know, in front of a different culture, and you are doing the dance, and they are, I'm going to imagine that in the beginning, probably some of them were just like, oh, here he comes. This is going to be rough. You get out there, you are competing at the highest level in front of, you know, let's face it, you were Alex Verdugo, and then in front of the baby, in front of the Fenway Park. How did you have the confidence to, like, not just walk off the stage? And you did the dance.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it wasn't a particularly traditional dance. I mean, I think I just kind of did whatever came to mind, which was obviously inspired by different aspects of traditional dance that I saw there. But I never really took any lessons or whatever. I just saw what other people were doing in dance parties and imitated it as closely as I could. But yeah, it was in that sort of circumstance, you know, it means so much to other people to have this person from outside their culture so fully embrace their culture. And that was part of what kept me going. Hmm. But you know, sometimes you just gotta commit. You gotta just put out any sort of conception of, oh, this might make me look silly, or yeah, you just got to commit to the bit, as they say.
Yeah.
And just put it out there, what you've got. And
that also
whatever happens will happen.
But that's confidence. Like, that's confidence of, like, I know what needs to be done. And you were, I mean, it was awesome. I mean, it was just like, I thought, oh my God, he's been taking classes. I think, I mean, it didn't look like some, you know, it looked legit to me.
And yeah.
People were cheering you on, which obviously that builds the confidence.
It helps.
But
I'm fascinated by
confidence in general, because I feel as though as a culture, I think it's harder and harder to kind of install confidence in, you know, young people.
Yeah. Yeah. It's tough. I mean, I think it's one of the ingredients of resilience, you know, in terms of just being able to adapt to whatever the situation happens to be. But yeah, I don't have a really great answer for why I have that confidence per se. I don't think of myself as a particularly confident person historically, though I think that now, looking on my life and the way I conduct myself, I think I do embody a certain kind of confidence in my day-to-day personality.
Humble confidence, I might add. I would say a very humble confidence. But now that I think about it, I think I know. It has to be from the performing as a child, as you and your family going up on stage and singing and playing music and doing your musicals as a family over and over and over again. That is almost a degree of practice for being able to be in front of people and kind of doing something that you might not normally do every day.
To a certain extent, I think you're right. But confidence also evolves over time, because when I was a young kid, I'd never get stage fright. I was always just happy to go up there and sing what I sing. But I was also, I had very kind of rigid conceptions of what I would be willing to sing and what styles of music I listen to and that sort of thing. And I was very much in a box in terms of my own conception of who I was. And growing up and kind of becoming a teenager, you know, starting to care more about what my friends thought about me, I had to really kind of come to grips with what it meant to perform, because I started getting stage fright. I started really getting into my head about, well, what if I mess up in this, on this song that I'm singing, or, you know, what if I play a wrong note, what's going to happen? And then you play a wrong note and then, you know, it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I don't know that I've ever really kicked that habit completely. I don't have the kind of precision when I'm performing music publicly that you know, a professional musician does, because I haven't fully overcome that tendency to overthink things. But there has been a, you know, just continuing to perform. Yeah, I have been attentive to the fact that, wow, in order to really perform, you need to stop thinking.
Yeah.
You need to stop thinking about what you're doing and just be in the moment.
I think about success in terms of like, and I don't see financial success. I see as like, I've always been on a path of like enlightenment, and it's like, and I feel as though now the older I get, the more I'm embracing of the idea of, you know, having some degree of enlightenment. And to me, I'm fascinated by how we act as people and how that affects our children, and then how those things affect our children, affect them as adults. And so to me, it's always been very much along the lines of like, it's all the giant experiment on, you know, basically gardening, you know, really what it comes down to. It's and how we can better ourselves in order for us to better the next generation.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good way to look at it.
Yeah, you know what? What do I know? My whole game. You really want to know my whole game? I'm not very philosophical. Everything is done from spite. Everything comes from a place of spite, and a lot of that spite came from not being believed in. And I needed to prove a few people wrong, and I willed myself into doing certain things to prove. The problem was when I was a kid, I didn't really have direction in which I wanted to go as a career. I loved sculpture and I loved making things, and my family didn't really give me the, how should we say, didn't give me some ideas in regards to what I should be doing with my life. So I became an art major thinking, well, this is the best thing I'm good at. And then there was a lot of, well, what is he going to do to be an artist? And I felt the need as soon as I graduated, before I graduated, I was an intern for our sculptors, and I felt the need to prove that I wasn't going to be some dilettante. And it was all spite. It was all based on like, you ain't going to tell me that I'm a fool around guy. I'm not going to be a fool around guy. I'm going to be taken seriously.
Yeah.
So it all, for me, it all comes from, and I, you know, I'm being glib, obviously, but you know, glib is good for me. I mean, it's fine by me. I ain't mad at it. And I know that a lot of my motivation is based on being told something I can't do.
Interesting. Yeah. So my motivation is like 180 degrees from that, because I was basically always told that I could do whatever I wanted and that I should do it whatever I wanted, because you'll do better at things that you enjoy. So yeah, I don't feel like I'm a spiteful person at all. I'm really happy for you that has been a strong enough motivator to get you where you are. Because
let me wait a second. Hold the phone. I'm not saying I'm a spiteful person. I'm saying some of my motivation is based off of spite. That doesn't mean I'm spiteful.
Okay.
I mean, sometimes I'm a little spiteful. Sometimes I'll be honest. Sometimes I'm a little bit spiteful. But honestly, it's the whole idea of don't tell me I can't do this.
Right.
You know, I'm going to make it happen. I'm going to make it happen. And that's just the way it is.
I get that. But it also comes from a confidence in yourself, a confidence of, you know, I can do this because I have the skills and I have the discipline that it takes to actually make it work.
I don't know. My other quote of the day is, you got to do whatever it takes, and sometimes your best isn't good enough. Sometimes you got to do it. I don't know. The expression is, you got to do sometimes your best isn't good enough. Sometimes you got to do whatever it takes. So I believe that, you know, sometimes it's whatever it takes. And if it's spite that motivates you, the funny thing is when I think about how I started doing asymmetrical knives, I think it's because somebody told me, oh, you're not allowed to do asymmetrical handles. No one wants to see that. And I was just like, all right, well, there you go. Thank you. I mean, that's all the motivation I needed. Thank you very much.
Asymmetrical handles, you're like doing different colors on different
I'll
sides?
I'll have a stripe on one side. I'll have a different color on the other, you know, but not like, it's meant to be, you know, just wacko for the sake of wacko. It's like very thoughtful in terms of like the left side and the right side are going to be different because they have a relationship with each other and they're speaking to each other. So it's not, you know, spontaneous, but it is like a relationship between the left side and the right side.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's something that other people don't do. So it's cool.
Well, you got to do whatever it takes. Sometimes your best isn't good enough, but the best is here. Jordan Lamote, you are the man. It's always great talking with you. You're an exceptional young man. I'm proud to know you. Jordan Lamote, go to jordanlamote.com. Is jordanlamote.com?
That's correct. Yep.
That's jordanlamote.com. You can get all of his information or get on his newsletter. You follow him on Instagram, Jordan Lamote. Is it just Jordan Lamote on Instagram?
Jordan Lamote Blades.
Jordan Lamote Blades. I'll have all the links in the show. In the show notes, wherever you're listening to this, all the show notes have all the links. Definitely go follow Jordan. Jordan's a great guy. And listen to the back episodes with him. He's the story of going to India. And one of my favorite episodes of all time is I had you on and you surprised me and everybody else. You came on the week before Blade Show and you announced on this show that you were going to go for, wasn't the journeyman, it was the master, right?
That was master. Yeah, that was when I was about to test for Master Smith.
You were about to test for Master Smith, and I'll tell you this story, and it dropped on Friday. The Blade Show was on Friday, and I got a blistering amount of DMs saying, how did he do? How did he do? That was awesome. Watching him, listening to the podcast, and how did he do? How did he do? That was one of my favorite episodes of all time because it was this, like, the perfect timing, so I appreciate you for that. And look, it's great to see you. I'm really proud for you and your family, and I look forward to seeing what you do next.
Man, you make me smile, Jeff. Thank you. What an honor.
Well, don't worry about that. Half of it's my spite. Don't worry about that. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding, obviously. Guys, follow Jordan. Jordan's the man, and we will see you next week. Jordan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeff. I really appreciate it.
All right. We'll see you next week, guys.
Your child has so much potential, but your local schools may not be right for them. Check out K-12. K-12 powered schools are accredited tuition-free online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 2 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.